Hello and welcome to the Outdoor Voices podcast, the podcast where we explore the world outside through interviews with the outdoor community. I'm your host, Bracken of BrackenOutdoors.com. Today in episode 11, I interview Lee Marie Rodriguez. Lee Marie is a lecturer in psychology for the University of Wales and an advocate for not just using the natural world as a tool, but truly developing a deep and holistic connection to our environment. In this episode, we talk about valuing outdoor space, the role of outdoor practitioners in mental health, deepening our connection to nature, and so much more. So without rambling on further, I will say, Lee Marie, welcome to the Outdoor Voices podcast.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here and being able to chat about our different practices. So thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, thank you very much for joining us. And yeah, before we get into what we really want to talk about with nature-based interventions and well-being and all of that, to get the listeners to connect with you a bit, could you tell us a little bit about how you ended up where you are now, what kind of really introduced you to liking the outdoors and everything else?
Well, that's kind of a long story in a short story, but I'll do a short version. I am from Puerto Rico, the Caribbean. That's where I was born and raised and spent most of my life. And so I would say, actually, I was naturally into nature. And that's part, you know, primarily because of the climate and the weather. You know, we have tropical weather there. It's kind of very easy wanting to be outside because it gets quite hot and quite warm. And yeah, so growing up, you know, living on an island, so I spent a lot of time, outside, swimming, surfing. My dad had a boat. He still had a boat. So we did a lot of fishing and diving. So that was kind of my world, like my natural way to being kind of in connection. But interestingly, it wasn't, obviously growing up, I wasn't thinking in these terms of, oh, this is my nature connection. that's something that came later as part of my work as a psychologist, as a researcher in mental health and well-being. And I ended up in the UK. I've been based in the UK for more than 10, 11 years now. I was in London doing my PhD in psychology. My areas of work are primarily young people, mental health and well-being, particularly adolescents and young adults. Previously I've looked into substance misuse problems, emotional development, and some aspects related to recovering in mental health, basically. And lately, I've been more involved because of my work and living in Wales is a great, big part of that as well. It's looking into and developing interventions or practices that help young people or support young people in their recovery from mental health problems, but also hopefully that these practices become part of their well-being as well. So not just as a tool for recovery, but also that these are practices and skills and things that they can do for their own well-being beyond the recovery. And this, that's kind of what my work is trying to focus on and move towards that direction more. Yeah.
I really identify with this. You're talking about the outdoor life being almost natural. Like you don't think of it as, okay, I'm going to go outdoors. I'm going to be in nature. It was just a normal part of life. And I grew up with that in South Africa. It was everyone was outside. It's hot. The weather's good. Yeah. Where else are you going to be? You get booted out of the house for your parents, regardless of age, and you're outside all the time. Do you think it's just the weather? Is that why UK doesn't quite have anything similar? Or is it access to spaces, do you think?
That's a very interesting question. It's an interesting question in the sense that, I've been in, a couple of years ago, I went to Norway, for example. It was for a job, some work I was doing there. And, you know, people do, you know, you see people outside and it's really cold. So there's, all, you know, sometimes with the UK, I think it's a tricky one because I think I would say the weather here varies much more than Norway, for example. And yet people not, they're not naturally that keen to be outside. I think that there are changes, but, you know, for example, one of the, I would say the first question you get often is complain about the weather or how's the weather, or a lot of what we do, you know, the weather forecast on the Met Office website. So it's that mindset around the weather and the climate, and perhaps we have, as a country, we, for some reason, which I don't know, historically we've developed this kind of mindset towards rain and cold weather, and instead of, you know, finding ways to embrace it and find a way to feel more comfortable around it. And in fact, that's one of the issues that I often have to find myself trying to address with participants in groups, trying to, you know, we plan a day and all of a sudden the weather changes completely and it's raining a lot. And so I'm really trying, you know, trying to nudge people, just let's make it work. Let's find a way that we can, maybe we cannot stay the whole day outside, but we try to embrace it and trying to find ways to enjoy the rain and find a way to enjoy the, you know, that the kind of ambience that that brings as well psychologically. Because that could be, that can be often one of the key barriers for people to go outside. Perhaps less these days because the weather is a bit milder. But, you know, when we reach, I don't know, say December, January, February, especially, those months can be quite hard for some people mentally to actually go wanting to go outside.
Yeah, and I guess it's trying to get people into the habit and kind of idea of having the right clothing and being able to first of all have kind of self agency, so they know there's ways that they can cope with the weather. So they know they've got a waterproof jacket, they know they've got a big wool jumper that will help keep them warm. They know they have ways to regulate the weather, and yeah, then they're also in that habit of going out. So it's a normal part of life. I guess that's a lot of what I do as to try and get people outdoors, is just trying to get that habit in. Once they've gone out with us for every week for 5-6 months, suddenly it's a lot easier for them to push themselves a little bit and get out.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, you can see the changes when people have some sense of frequency, or, you know, when something becomes more habitual. Yeah, that's for sure. People start thinking of less of how I'm not going to go out, and actually, yeah, I'm looking forward to going outside and spend good time with my dad.
But you're right. It's a challenge. It's a challenge, and I think we've got a lot of indoor people these days, and I imagine COVID and everything hasn't really helped that. Fewer organized activities, and for some people, organized activities are the only reason to get out. There's a few adults that I worked with last year, and we had to suspend the conservation sessions that we were doing. And essentially, some of these people went without human contact for the entire time during all of the lockdowns, and it's only when we're able to resume sessions that they appeared like a bluebell out of the woods and said, "Hi, oh, great, it's great, I finally have an excuse to go out and talk to people."
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, it's a big one. I think we're still in that transition. I know the government guidelines are going to be changing tomorrow. But I can speak for myself. I find it really hard going back to, I don't want to say normality, but, you know, going back to the normal things we were doing before the pandemic, like, you know, shopping, having a wander, meeting a friend for coffee. I was struggling with that and having lots of people around me, and, you know, is that sense of safety as well, because you're hyper aware of all the, you know, wash your hands and all of that. And so it has taken some time for me to kind of let my body and my mind to adapt again to that changing environment. And sometimes I'm not really enjoying that. It's fine, it's too much, too many people after, you know, almost a year of going to a shop and it was so quiet and empty. So I think it's very important to be aware that people are still making those transitions and adapting to, again, to a new sense of normality or changes that are still taking place. Yeah.
Yeah. At the same time, there seems to be more interest than ever in getting outside and being outdoors and making the most of the local spaces, because that's all people had often enough.
And there's been a couple of studies examining how people relied or connected with nature during the lockdown. And there's been a couple of surveys, and I mean, part of me is like, you know, of course, but you know, there's some evidence now that shows that, yeah, effectively there was a significant increase of people going outside and doing different activities to try to spend time outdoors fundamentally. And I think, you know, if we look at media, for example, news, newspaper, we see more of those kind of messages. There was the last Mental Health Awareness Week was all about nature. So the Mental Health Foundation was leading some of the campaigning for that. It was all about connecting with nature, wildlife trust. They had a huge campaign going on. So I would say there's definitely more awareness of the benefits of connecting with our natural environments and trying to spend more time outdoors, and with that as well bring some challenges, I would say, because we also see more rubbish, more noise, and people, for example, now in West Wales, there's a lot of paddleboarding. It's a huge trend, and there's been a couple of people getting lost, and they need a rescuing. So it's, you know, it's just great, you know, from the perspective that, you know, people are really trying to invest in activities outside, but also there's still a lot of education needed about around safety and, you know, awareness of some of the precautions that are needed when you're going outside. So it's like pros and cons.
You want more people outside with you, but then at the same time you go, okay, but first you need to kind of join the club with the behaviors, so you need to be on board with the behaviors that we expect of people who spend time outside. So it's kind of, people are split in two ways. It's like, wow, there's so many people around, this is great. And then there's also, wow, there's so many people around, I was hoping to get away.
Yeah, but that's a point. And the thing is that, you know, take, for example, Wales, you know, there's green areas everywhere. This is a green country from north to south. But yeah, we have very, very few places where people can go for that kind of nature connection. And that's mostly through parks. Or at least that's the first impression, because the second question would be, why are people not connecting through the local places or communities? And we can say, for example, urbanized areas will have different challenges because the green spaces are much more limited. And that's something that needs to be addressed. So we research is quite clear that outdoor nature should be at your footstep. It shouldn't be a long journey, you know, to a park in order to be able to see trees. So ideally, so there needs to be a much more coordinated effort to try to, or you know, create more green spaces in urbanized areas, and not just send people to parks all the time, because that's kind of the expected chaos. If ever you're sending this big message to the country that, yeah, nature is great, outdoor is fantastic, but then where do you go for that? So yeah, People go to parks, and you know, that's when you can go. So then we have these incidents when just too many people, and then, you know, it becomes, yeah, that's when we see lots of problems around how we manage rubbish and people not having the right equipment or the right clothing, for example. There's huge, for example, in Snowdonia, the weather can really drop all of a sudden. It can start sunny and then 3 hours later, you're just completely just freezing. Yeah. Always very weak. So again, so some of the things that we need, I would say, that's the level of education and awareness and preparedness, being able to enhance your experience outside and also for other people as well.
So when I was kind of looking through things that was interested in talking to you about, I came across the World Health Organization article. So the one, Nature and Biodiversity Play a Vital Role in Protecting Human Health.
Yeah.
I think that talked a lot about that kind of valuing nature beyond just, farming. So actually, we say we're not just valuing an area based just on whether it produces timber or food, but we're actually saying, okay, it needs to exist for health.
Yeah.
Do you remember, are you familiar with that article and everything? And would you like to talk about it?
The World Health Organization has now has published policy and guidance to, push governments to take more proactive steps to encourage people to engage with activities outdoors and what we call nature-based interventions for health and well-being. And I would say Wales, in that sense, is quite advanced to a certain degree. I mean, we, for example, in West Wales, there's the Nature Health Services Network. It's been running for quite a few years now, more than 10 years, I would say. And there's more than, I think last time I checked, there were more than 50 different projects of nature-based services around West Wales, and that's quite a lot. So I think from one side, I would say definitely that there's tons of evidence that demonstrate the importance of valuing nature beyond, the basic necessities of like food and shelter and all of that. So now that we are more aware with evidence that this is more about as well our mental health, psychological health, and how we cope with stress. And therefore that now the evidence is very important then for the government to allocate funding for initiative based on or looking or trying to create programs that use nature or are based in nature to promote mental health and well-being. And I'm literally using the word use because that's often what comes with this paradigm. And what I mean with that is that I would say one of the issues with this or limitations with this kind of policy is that the way that they interpret in nature is still very transactional. It's kind of, I go outside in nature and nature does this for me and then I go home. And I think there's some work now emerging that is kind of departing from that kind of utilitarian relationship with nature. It's more trying to develop a more holistic relationship with nature, trying to look like what we do to nature, but also how we can help nature. And that's when the whole idea of biodiversity. So how can we have a reciprocal relationship with natural environment and not just go and take and take and take, even for my own well-being? It's not just going out, having a good time, being very peaceful and relaxed. But when I go out, I try to pick up some rubbish. I try to, there's a huge problem with ash here. So I try to have a look if there's anything I notice that I need to be reporting. So I just take a proactive role because that environment now is part of myself. And that, I would say, what we call level 2 ecotherapy. So it's more about our ecological relationship with the environment and not just taking from nature, just having a good time, going back home, leave it there. So there are some elements that are there in the policy that the World Health Organization is pushing, and it's kind of the language that governments understand, which is the assets and values. We have this concept of natural capital, for example.
Really what we're looking to go back to. I mean, it's we hear a lot about it in terms of the Native Americans and their relationship with the wild, because they actually almost cultivated the forests in some way, like a permaculture food forest, where they'd burn bits and they'd let other bits grow, and they'd help nature along in return for what nature gives. That it, as you say, it's that holistic kind of give and take, and it's something that as humans we've had for centuries. I mean, if you didn't look after the area around you, if you just took away, it would eventually be no more. And yeah. I think we've kind of lost that we've kind of separated. So there's stuff that we do for nature, like conservation, and then there's enjoying nature, and it's almost like they're two different things that don't cross over.
We still I think that there's some, let's say, psychologists, environmentalists, that they for years, I would say, and there's a whole range of literature that they've been trying, sort of writing to promote or put out there this more holistic ecological mindset. So it's not new, really. But it's not until now that we see, and especially that this is a huge trend now of all the forest bathing, forest therapy, ecotherapy, that we still see a lot of that, what we call level one ecotherapy or nature intervention, that is kind of, it has that kind of transactional, you know, how can I benefit from nature instead of looking more the big picture, you know, and seeing what you, like you just said, you know, that relationship, reciprocal relationship that we have with the environment, nature.
So level two activities would be a bit more like conservation work, so like tree planting and controlling invasive species, and I don't know, would it be more of that style of?
Yeah, I think I would say that as a practitioner, that part, that really depends on the practitioner and how the practitioner is approaching his work. Because you can, you know, I've been in different bushcraft skill sessions, and I have completely different experiences. So one of the bushcraft instructors was very, this is how you chop the wood, and this is how you manage the knife, and da 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 da. So he had a very utilitarian approach through the whole activity. Was all the bushcraft instructor, their way of being and the way they teach is much more aligned with the natural environment. And there's some element or some part of the activity that we try to help that that space, and we're trying to make it better, because it helps the birds, or we did some nesting or something, that there's an awareness that it's not just taking. And regardless of the bushcraft activity, the way they were approaching it, it felt really connected with that place. And the way they approach it, it felt like there's some, you know, connections with what they're doing and how they approach the natural environment where they are. So I think that part, or is greatly shaped by the practitioner and how they approach their work. And when I say practitioner, that includes, you know, bushcraft instructor, outdoor instructors, ecotherapists, psychologists, or, you know, a whole range of professions. Yeah.
Okay, that's really interesting. I hadn't thought of it that way, but I guess it's transitioning, because in bushcraft we talk a lot about the difference between bushcraft and survival.
Yeah.
Survival is kind of man versus wild. Uh-huh. And then bushcraft is kind of, okay, I'm going to start interpreting what the woodlands tell me. I'm going to start not going, okay, that tree is just purely, I can get antiseptic fungus from that tree, or I can use that herb to make soap. It's bushcraft's hopefully starts to transition towards, okay, that tree, that's a willow. That willow tells me where water is. That you start to gauge it, but you're talking about going even kind of further into the kind of almost integrating, I guess, if you go to permaculture principles, it comes back to some things like return of surplus, doesn't it? You're doing an activity, but then you're also thinking about, okay, I've taken these resources out. Is there anything left that I can give back?
I say that I think something that I'm hoping will change as well is that, you know, because the diversity of practitioners of people, you know, work in the outdoors, you know, people can come from very different backgrounds, and that I think sometimes that can be misleading in the sense that we split, you know, this is the environmental stuff or conservation work, and this is the nature connection stuff, this is the mental health stuff, and this is the physical health stuff, and it's all comes together really. I think we've been using that word holistic and becoming more an ecological practitioner. So you can teach, like, you know, like you described, this an activity, a very specific activity, like, you know, how to handle a knife or something like that. But you can bring that element of nature connection, and, you know, you can approach activity in a very mindful way. You know, you don't have to rush in, and, you know, and you can bring that, all those elements together through the work you're doing and how you approach the woodland and the forest you're working in, and how you talk to people, your rhythm through the session and things like that. And I think we see more of that.
It's all about the journey and not so much about the destination. You might turn something out at the end, but it's how you got there that also has a lot of value and is really important.
We see more of people, for example, I work with a local organization, Smallwoods, and they have their program Active Woods. So it's all about promoting woodlands for well-being. And that includes bushcraft, bushcraft skills. So bushcraft skill, bushcraft is effectively being used to promote mental health and well-being. And the way I think it has a great deal of potential in the sense of, you know, one of the key issues that I see with patients or clients is that of not feeling that they want to spend more time outside, that the perception of safety, that, you know, that's a big one for women, for example. So when they go through, you know, learn how to fire, you know, fire lighting skill, you know, how to manage a knife, or you can set up a tub, you can get water if you lose your flask or something. So that already enhances your experience of being outdoors, and that can make huge, you know, life changes for some people. And the enjoyment, you know, you can learn a lot about mindfulness whilst you know, engaging with some of these activities as well. Be concentrated, pay attention how you posture your body and, you know, your head and all of that, and, you know, being careful how you're managing your tools. So there are great ways of learning about mindfulness. So
yeah, are you familiar with Liz Benstead?
I've heard.
We had her on the podcast recently, earlier this year, and we did a lot of talking about bushcraft and mindfulness because she's setting up that program with Dave Watson and everything, and so yeah, we've talked quite a bit about how bushcraft can be a kind of introduction to kind of holistic well-being. But it's all about it, no matter how you do it, it's all about giving someone tools so that they can feel, first of all, feel comfortable outdoors, like you say, removing the fear, and then you can start looking at, okay, once you've removed the fear, okay, I lost the train of thought now. Well, what else would you say that is critical to kind of overcome going into that?
Yeah, it's the perception of safety. I think what I would say as well, or I would add, is I remember one of my favorite books is Paul Kirtley. I really enjoy his podcast and his program, because the way I see it is that I'm trying to bring bushcraft skills into my outdoor life. And I think he actually says that at some point. But that's my impression anyway. So when I listen to his podcast and his videos and all that, it gives me a sense that how can I bring that skill into, when I go outdoor cycling, I feel very confident that I can use this type of knife or something, or, it makes it very accessible. And it's easier for me to bring that into the things that I already like and enhances my experience when I go camping, and I've done some expedition. And that's why I'm very interested in bushcraft, because it enhances my skills. It makes me feel independent, autonomous, safe. It doesn't put me off from a walk. Like, look scary. Oh, I can carry a knife. I can do that. Whereas I know that a lot of bushcraft these days is more about the bushcraft itself. So you go, it's more like almost like a hobby. So you learn different fire lighting techniques and people really enjoy that. And I think that's a very important thing. But to me, what I take the most of bushcraft is when I can bring it into my life more, and learn, having this skills that are enhancing my experience of the outdoors, regardless of the activity I'm doing. If it's cycling or running, or if I went camping, even go steering or things like that. And I think that's something very important when we think about specific groups of people, like women, young people, that to make it a bit more accessible in that way.
Yeah, I've got back onto my train of thought. So what I was going to say was that once you've removed the fear, okay, so you teach, so to get people in, you start teaching them skills, because that's the easiest way to get a lot of people interested in something, is to say, hey, come over here and I'll teach you this. And then it starts to remove the fear, and they start to become more comfortable. They start being able to take care of themselves outside. That starts giving them independence. Yeah. And then as you get kind of deeper into the skills, you start getting the immersion. Yeah. So for me, when I was introduced to foraging, that was a major thing for me, because like, I can eat stuff that's just out there. It suddenly, you can never look at a hedge the same way again. No. You go, oh, hawthorn, oh, is that meadowsweet? You start seeing if. You know, I don't know, this is a bit cliche and everything, but as I go for a walk, I see friends.
Yeah.
It's like, I know you. Yeah, I've seen you before. Burdock. Oh, you're very tasty. and you start merging, and that's something I talked about, I think, a couple of times on the podcast. I'm sure I talked about it with the interview with Tara, sure I talked about it with Liz. It was that study that said that actually there's, your forest bathing, your kind of just walking through the woods is a very low level kind of engagement. You get some mental health benefits, it's not an insignificant amount, but then if you actually engaging, if you actually almost part of the woodland again, then suddenly you get those further benefits, and then they start spilling over. So you kind of get, as you said, when you're out cycling or whatever, you might bring that in. If you're out with some friends and you stop by a pub garden, you might see some really interesting, tasty flowers in there and be able to amaze your friends, and that will give you cultural capital, social capital. So it kind of starts to spill over as you get deeper, as you become part of the web, instead of just kind of sitting from outside and going, okay, there's a mountain, I'm going to climb it, rather than going, oh, I wonder what I can see up that mountain, or I don't even need to go to that mountain, my local area is fascinating enough.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, everything changes day to day.
And that's something that I, that I really, it became very, very real. I was facilitating virtual mindfulness in nature sessions for active woods, small woods, and I think it's initially okay. So how do I do this? How do I? And I realized that nature's everywhere, and nature's indoor, you know, like spiders, or if you have a pet, or if you have plants, and some people, I remember looking at, you know, we were all in Zoom, and I could see people's living rooms or rooms or whichever part of the house they were in, and I couldn't see anything nature. So I would say, well, taste the water, you know, and try, you know, what sort of quality that brings into your awareness, and the air, you know, and if you look outside, and I asked them, just notice what's moving around you. So yeah, I can see some leaves. So nature's everywhere, and not only that, we are nature. So we talk about nature like something that's outside, that's just in, you know, in the world out there, but we are nature. And I think that's something that through the experience of, you know, moving everything online, it helped me to really process that in a very concrete way, of thinking more creatively about keeping that awareness and less thinking of indoors and outdoors, and just being aware of myself in part of nature, in connection with all these living things that are also living with me. I live in a rural area, so I have lots of spiders in this house. And I have names. I say, hello, how are you doing today? And I think that's a very important aspect to think about, you know, that even indoors, we can be aware of nature and connect with nature in that way as well.
I was just thinking of the similarities with the growth of natural movement. So where people are saying, okay, it's great that you go out and you go on a run every day, or you go out cycling every day and you do that for 1 hour. But then if you're coming back home and sitting at your desk for the other 10, you're really not getting the full benefits. You really want more of an everyday immersion, whether you notice the dandelion growing right in the middle of the railway tracks, or if you look up when you're in the city and you walk into the office and you see the falcons. And there's ways, once you have the toolkit, once you have, as you were talking about that toolkit, once you start really looking and really noticing, it opens up a whole different world.
Yeah, and I would say that's the key work as practitioners, regardless of your, what, you know, if it's bushcraft or mindfulness, your guide was attention. That I say that's your main job. Just, you know, guiding them in a way that they can see, you know, they become aware that there's something there that they can look and experience as well. I would say that's 90% of my work as a practitioner.
So we've talked quite a bit at an abstract level, I would say, about we said there's all of these benefits to being outdoors. What would you say are kind of the top three things, things you think might be least talked about, or three benefits of just getting outside, being outside?
Yeah, I would say the main one is, you know, stress. So not getting stressed, but it helps managing stress. And this is a double-sided issue, because, you know, we live in I remember listening to David Aram saying, you know, our goofy civilization. And this is very interesting, because I teach a module on stress coping and resilience. And when I start describing and discussing with my student what stress, and stress as such is not a bad thing. Stress is a wonderful thing. It's how our bodies cope with, you know, how he survives, actually, talking about survival.
Or so mucus and everything.
But stress as such is not bad, you know, and actually you need a little bit of stress to perform well. There's a whole range of research on high-performance athletes, and we can all probably say you have experienced that yourself with a little bit of stress during an exam, that actually you need that focus and that adrenaline to focus it. But when we are in trouble, when we're talking about, you know, chronic stress, so our bodies cannot cope with being on stress continuously, nonstop. So when we go outdoors, our bodies stray away, and there's lots of evidence showing how the physiological responses taking place in your body when you are walking through a forest, or you're walking, or you're going for a swim, for example. So physiologically, it helps to manage with the stress response by relaxing your body. So I would say that's one of the main benefits.
What is it about the? I mean, this is probably still an area under active research. I mean, what exactly?
Yeah.
I mean, when I read a book about forest bathing, it was talking a lot about the smells of a lot of the conifers, were really just straight out triggering something in the brain. Is it a lot of that? Is it visual? Is it kinesthetic? Is it everything?
I would say it's everything. It's a combination of things. I mean, I know from a Western perspective, we come with a very scientific mindset and we want to get all the needs of, you know, the work. And so, for example, the practice of forest bathing was born in Japan in the early 1980s. The Minister of Tourism created this strategy, marketing strategy, to promote Japanese people. The stress level were so high. And there was the prevalence of chronic illnesses, which are often stress related. They needed some strategy, health strategy, at the country level to promote people to do something about the stress. So that's how he started creating the. They started developing this concept of forest bathing. But also Japan has a long history tradition of Zen Buddhism and meditation. So forest bathing has elements of that embedded in how they approach the practice. And that opened the door to tons of research in Japan about their physiological effects. So trees, like pine trees, release chemicals that when we smell them, they go into our bloodstream, and that they've measured actually that the stress response goes go down just by smelling trees. But then as they go, they've done more research in looking at different aspects of forest bathing experience, then there's a visual element. There's a theory that says that we're meant to be looking at different paths, because when you go outside, nothing is linear. They all have different paths and shapes. So that, again, at the visual perception level, has an impact on the way your body responds and activates a relaxation response, but fundamentally. Yeah. And same with I would say the second benefit is beauty. So we need beauty in our life. We need to, and that's every single human being. We need to look at beauty. This research that demonstrate that we need to go beyond nature, and this is why we go to the experiential level of things and being outdoors. I've never seen, I've met someone who doesn't like nature and say, "Oh, nature is ugly." I haven't met that person yet. They might not like the weather, or they might be uncomfortable, but the aesthetics of it is very important. And there's some research from Ulrich in did this famous experiment in hospitals in the US, where there were patients that they were in recovery from surgery, and they were in a room looking outside trees, and those who had some natural landscape to look at recover much faster than those who didn't. So I would say that's the second benefit of the aesthetics of it, and that for yourself.
How would you define beauty in that? Because as the saying goes, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Is there a definition for what is beautiful? Is it I don't know, maybe I'm trying to bring it down to a scientific level where it shouldn't really be, but it's kind of like it does our brain notice pleasing geometry there, like, oh, look, that fits together and it's a pretty color, or what do you think?
I mean, there are theories on the aesthetic or discipline around that. But I think when it comes to nature or natural environment, is the diversity of things, you know. And I think you immediately notice. So for example, yeah, we and it's green, you know. Obviously, there's lots of green, but actually, there's different many types of green out there. It's not one green, it's just lots of different green and tones. But there's something about that diversity and variety that seems to be experienced, you know, as a very pleasant thing to have, you know. And I mean, there are other elements of that around, you know, not everything about nature is fluffy and perfect, and like that, you know, nature can be brutal. You know, since I moved to this rural area, these rural wilds, you know, I've seen lots of dead animals for a variety of reasons, you know, natural causes, or sheep that die, you know, in giving birth, you know, and sometimes I'm, you know, I've become, because I'm more embedded in nature, I can see also the brutal aspects of you know, how nature works to thrive and survive. But in general, when we talk about at the level of psychological benefits and well-being, there's definitely something about the aesthetics of it. And you know, sometimes I work with people that, for a variety of reasons, they can go outside because they struggle with social anxiety or some disability. So what I often try to do is to encourage them to have plants indoors or have a picture of a place in nature that you really enjoy. Because there's this, again, there's tons of research that shows that even looking at images of nature, people demonstrate, you know, higher scores of relaxation. Yeah. So you know, so there's quite a lot of that. That seems to be key and very important about the benefits.
Yeah, it's almost like I think that's the thing, that people often don't think of our brain as a very ancient organ, but it's mostly still used to being in a world where everything was natural. And I think part, going back to kind of the stress, part of the stress is I don't think our brain really knows how to deal with the modern world. Like cars and pavements and buildings everywhere. There's something in about probably just doesn't know. It's like if you dropped a 300 a man from 300 years ago right into the middle of London, he'd have a mental breakdown because just wouldn't have a structure to be able to decode what was going on there. And think about it, most of our brain is way older than that.
Yeah, absolutely. There's some interesting writing by a psychologist called David Kitner, and he writes about depression being a result of our bodies and our mind trying to cope with this civilization that we've developed, and that's the cause of all mental health problems, pretty much.
Yeah, I
You know,
mean,
it's,
a lot of people talk about this whole our brain is a stress response is designed to react to the saber-toothed tiger is a cliche and run away extra fast, but now it thinks we're constantly being chased by that just because someone said something that we didn't agree with, and suddenly we feel that the same response, and then nature just comes in and goes, "Nope. You're not being chased. Everything's okay. Calm."
calm. Yeah, there's something in about thinking, you know, the way we talk about or the way we think about mental health disorders, and we treat them separately as, you know, as the end result, but actually they are more symptoms of how we're trying to cope with a world that is very unnatural. So yeah, there's a thought there. I think the third benefit is connecting with people, you know, connecting with all the animals, you know, plants or trees, but also connecting with ourselves. I think, you know, we're having this need in here, and, you know, most of the day, I have a long day in the computer, blah, blah, blah. I'm so self-absorbed, you know, in all this stuff in my head, you know, and when I go outside, I really connect with not only what's, you know, in my immediate environment, but with myself, like, how am I doing, how am I feeling, you know, what am I aware of, you know. And I think that's just the, you know, a very important benefit, because of the previous two benefits, you know, we know that being outdoor immediately help your body relax, looking at beauty, and therefore it's easier to connect with yourself and with other people and with animals and all what's around there, you know, other forms of, you know, what I call sentience, you know, there are things that are living around you. And this is where the work that any form of ecotherapy, nature-based intervention is basically fundamentally trying to promote. And that's something that I've come across with my research, is that the main reason people with, you know, coping or struggling with a mental health problem, the number one reason they really enjoyed being outdoors is connecting with other people. They didn't say, yeah, I like the trees, I love sitting in a circle around the fire, but the favorite part is connecting with people. It's being outside, sitting together, having a cup of coffee or tea. You know, that's often the favorite part. So that says a lot, I think.
I think there's a quality of connection with other people that you can only get in natural spaces. Admittedly it's often different people, but if you think of the difference of people meeting in, say, a crowded cafe, and then people meeting outside around a campfire, it's like you must first empty the cup before you can fill the cup. The thought process that once people have calmed down and they're not as stuck in their own heads, and as you say, they've almost held up that mirror, they've come to terms with where they are now, they've come back into the present, then you can really start to connect. It's like if you've probably been with someone who is really distracted. They're not quite in the conversation, like whether it's their phone going off or whether there's just a lot going on, or they're right in the middle of a report when you've disturbed them, and they're not quite engaged with the conversation. And there's almost like this little wall, like one of those COVID plexiglass screens that just slides down, and it stops. It reduces the connection a bit. But then when you are totally relaxed and you're kind of sitting back and the stars in the sky, campfire TV in front of you, it's almost like a totally different space to connect, isn't it?
Absolutely. And that's also something that I noticed when I work outside, outdoors. You know, when I'm working indoors with a group, part of my work as a psychologist is trying to relax and trying to build rapport and trying to get people to the present. And, you know, and they come with all of worries and stress, and I don't know how I'm going to pay this and my partner and that noise. And so a lot of first great part of my work as a psychologist is trying to bring them down. Okay, let's try to focus on one thing at a time. So when I'm outside, that part is easier. Because being outside already relaxed, people already feel more relaxed. It's easier to start, you know, that grounding exercise. Just notice your breathing, and you know, and we can go straight to an activity. When doing that indoors, I have to spend more time doing exercises or some activity just to calm people or help them to calm down, so we can actually then start with an activity. And that's how. In forest bathing practice, that a practitioner would say that the therapist is the forest. I'm just there as a facilitator, kind of opening the door to the forest, so people go there and the rest. But yeah, it's a very important observation. Yeah,
that's a beautiful kind of analogy, opening the door into the forest. I think that perfectly sums up the role. It's like we're not there to tell people how they should interact with nature.
Yeah.
We're just there to introduce them. It's like,
yeah.
Person, meet nature. Now I'm going to lead you to it.
Yeah.
Well, I want to be respectful of your time. I'm sure you've got some things to wrap up before the end of the week and everything. So, but before we go, there's one last question that I ask every guest without fail. It is, if someone is looking to get outside more often, what advice would you have for them?
You know, just to be outside, if you have a garden, start with your garden. Start cultivating a relationship with whatever local space you have that you can go to. So if it's not a garden, local park, or if there's any community project nearby that you can volunteer, there's more and more like gardening projects, things like that. That's a great way to start a relationship, because that's the key thing. You know, it's not just deep in our toes because we have a nature deficit. It's the fundamental benefit is developing a relationship with nature or natural environment. And that could also be done if for whatever reason someone cannot go outside. You can start develop your own indoor gardening kind of thing, you know, having some plants and things like that. And you know, I'm not saying that it's not a nice thing to do, to go to, you know, national parks. Obviously, they're great for walks. And they're so, you learn so much stuff about birds and foraging and all of that. So obviously, if you can make it to a national park and support a national park, fantastic. But we don't need to depend only on our parks to have that experience. So ideally, you should have your you know, outdoors at your footstep, and try to start locally what you have local. And I think that would be my main advice. And think about, you know, gradually work with your own awareness of nature, and where's nature looking inside your house and your flat, and where is it, and what's moving. And a really good simple guideline or principle is notice what you're noticing. So when I'm noticing, close my eyes, I can hear some chickens in the background. I was just listening to the rain a couple of minutes ago. If not, it's my, you know, notice what you're noticing. That's the easiest way to become aware of what we're processing.
Well, excellent. Again, before we go, if people would like to learn more about you and follow any of the work you're doing, where should I send people? Is there any way? Now you've got a Twitter account. Is there anywhere else people are interested?
Yeah. No, I have to confess, I'm not great with social media, but I'll it's on my agenda. But I would say for now, it's probably Twitter, because then that I will promote local projects, local activities, and also any work that I'm publishing will be posted there as well.
That's excellent. Well, thank you so much. I had an absolute blast, and thank you for coming on the podcast.
Oh, thank you. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
As I've said before, mental health has definitely become a defining issue of our generation, and the pandemic, who must not be named, has definitely heightened our awareness of the importance of mental health. I could have chatted to Lee Marie for hours. I would love to get her on a second time where we can start to dig even deeper into her own research and sheer wealth of knowledge. For now, I will just hope that you enjoyed this episode and remind you that the show notes can be found at brackenoutdoors.com/episode and the number 11, as well as all of my blog posts, resources and activities that I have going. Thanks again for listening. I'll talk to you soon.